Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. Hal Rubenstein. There's so many titles to speak of here. I mean, you're an award-winning journalist, columnist, restaurant critic. You are the founder of the soon-to-be platform this fall, The Happy Grown-Up. You were previously the founding editor of Details, Egg, and InStyle magazines. You've held positions as fashion director of InStyle, New York Times Men's Magazine. You've been columnists at The New Yorker, Vogue, Elle, Forbes, New York Magazine. I mean, the list goes on. And then you've been the author of 7 books, including the best-selling 100 Unforgettable Dresses. You have another book coming out on the most stylish TV shows coming in 2023. And if this wasn't enough, you, of course, also consult behind the scenes for major brands, hotels, restaurants. You're an on-air personality. You've had your line on HSN. Mm-hmm. And you are also the recipient of CFDA Lifetime Achievement Award. So first of all, I love that I've worked with you and I know you and I know your talent, but I'm so honored to have you on the podcast. Welcome to Leave Your Mark.
Well, thank you so much, Aliza. I'm glad to be here. I really am. You're doing such cool stuff with such cool people and you're bringing people on and you're getting listeners excited to people they didn't know about.
Oh,
and that's
thank
and
you.
That's important.
Well, Hal, there's so much to dive into. And I was trying to think of how to do this episode in a way that would really capture your essence because we would need 10 hours to really talk about your career. And a couple highlights that I just want to share with everyone. So Hal is a New Yorker. He is a consummate student. He started reading at the age of 3.
Yes.
I mean, you come from a family of seamstresses and sewers, and you have always grown up with an appreciation of fashion. But I have to just ask you, if you had to choose your favorite fashion or food, what is the ultimate?
It's okay. This is not an evasive answer, but you can't make a choice simply because I think they're so completely interconnected. If you think about all the divisions that we think of as art, you know, painting, sculpture, music, food, fashion. However, there's something distinctive about these two. If there was no more sculpture in the world, if we woke up tomorrow morning and all the sculpture in the world vanished, it would suck, but it really wouldn't change your life. If you woke up tomorrow and all the paintings were gone in the world, it would suck, but it wouldn't change your life. But every morning, everybody, regardless of age, regardless of income, regardless of ethnicity, everybody gets up in the morning and everybody asks the same 2 questions to themselves. What am I going to eat? And what am I going to wear?
Oh, yes.
And because
so
of that,
true.
Am I right?
Yes.
Yes. Because of that, these 2 elements of our lives are something that every single person on earth has a participation in. And consequently, I can't separate the two. And especially when you think about these day and age, considering the restrictions that we have, some of the only places in the world where we ever do get dressed up is to go out to eat. But the fact is, they're both essential elements of our lives. And I think they're also both great sources of happiness and joy in our lives. And consequently, I can't see taking them apart.
All right, fine. You play the 5th. So if you had to identify your first break in the industry, what would that be?
Annie Flanders, the late Annie Flanders. I started writing as soon as I got out of college. And I was lucky. I got jobs at 3 magazines. However, this was the 70s. There was a Great Recession. Gerald Ford said to New York, drop dead, all that stuff. And all these magazines folded and I developed writer's block. On a dare, I started a catering business.
Wow.
And I had a catering business for 10 years called Casual Grace. Very successful. It was during disco era. I had all the disco companies because all my friends were DJs. But more importantly, I used to cater for the production nights at the Soho News when Soho was just starting to grow. And Annie Flanders was the fashion director of the Soho News. And I would cater for her. And then she came to me one day and she said, I'm starting this new magazine called Details about all things that are fresh and different downtown. And she said, I want a film critic. And I said, oh, cool. Okay, let's do it. I'll give it a shot. I'll try writing again. About 2 weeks before the first article was due, Annie calls me and says, you know what? I decided that in a monthly magazine, nobody really reads a movie review. What I really want you to write about is food, is rest. And I went, oh my God. I said, no. I said, restaurant writing is so boring. Oh, there's too much sorrel in the soup. I said, who cares? And she said, but you love food. And I said, no, what I love about New York, I love going out to eat. I said, in New York City, where do we do everything? We do everything in restaurants. We do business dealings in restaurants. We meet our friends in restaurants. We try getting laid in restaurants. I said, restaurants are, it's true. Every social activity we do in New York is about going out to eat. And she said, good, then write about that. And I started the column called I'll Eat Manhattan. As Details became an incredibly influential magazine downtown, the restaurant column became incredibly influential as well. And that restaurant column, I'll Eat Manhattan, opened me up to writing for magazines like Vogue, the Daily News, and the Robb Report. Malcolm Forbes was a fan of the column, and that's how I got Egg Magazine. And Egg Magazine led to the New York Times. I don't mean to rush ahead.
No. I got to point out one thing that you didn't say.
Yeah.
It is true, though, that you worked for free for like a long time, right?
2 years. Annie had such a cool idea that almost everybody on that magazine at Details worked for IOUs for the first 2 years.
Did you ever get the IOU?
The only reason why Annie really had to start paying me decent money was that the Village Voice wanted to hire me away and offered me a decent amount of money back then to write. And I went to Annie and I said, look, they're offering me money. And I said, but I don't want to leave. I said, figure out a way to make me stay. I want to be here. And working with Annie and her great team, an amazing editor named Alan Weitz, these people just gave me an incredible platform and guided me in a way that I was able to hone my writing style, the idea of being able to give opinions by telling stories, by always having humor, by giving people a sense of relation so they understood exactly where I was coming from. So it was like they were sitting next to me. The idea of writing in an incredibly personal and very declarative manner. And I give Annie all that credit.
Hal, you are one of, honestly, the most prolific writers. And it's crazy because you have exceptional skill in being a food critic, but you have exceptional skill in reviewing fashion and film. And you've written about so many things over the course of your career. And one of the things that strikes me about you is you are truly one of the most opinionated people I've ever met in my entire life, in the best possible way.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the world we live in today and having strong opinions and being a critic, we see fashion journalists today, tech journalists today, that have gotten so much heat for having an opinion. What is your worldview on being someone with a strong opinion in the world today?
I've never really said, you know, I don't care, whatever you want to do is fine with me, or I don't really know. I mean, I never talk about things I don't know about, but that idea of just, you know, whatever is not in my vocabulary. I don't understand not having opinions on things. Look, all you have is your five senses to deal with, but you know exactly what pleases you and you know what offends you. And I'm very aware of the fact that social media today has made people terrified of opinions, of having any. Oh, no, they're scared shitless. And one of the reasons why is there are scores of people who sit on the internet just waiting to be offended. They live for this. It's like food for them. They get off on this. And, you know, my attitude really to them is screw them, because as long as you have the power of your opinion, before you shoot your mouth off, you better have a firm footing. I don't give opinions unless I truly believe in what I'm saying. But I think it's never been more important now to have an opinion, to stand there in a world that's so contentious, that's so contemptuous of things that are outside people's realm. I think it's important to dig your heels in and firmly say, this is what I believe in, and I'm going forward with this. I think it's the only way to be happy with yourself. I think it's the only way to satisfy and go forward with the people around you. It's the only way to be true and honest with your friends and your family and your work. But to sit there and let other people's opinions guide you or drag you or steal you, I think it's very dangerous. I think it's very dangerous to sit in the back and let somebody else go forward. I used to have a wonderful acting teacher named David LeGrant, who said that most people live in the world of gray careful. You know, they want to go forward, but it's really hard to go forward if you always have your foot in the back door just in case.
Right.
I don't believe in the just in case. When you watch the people who move the needle, when you watch the people who, quote, make a mark in this world, they're people who have an opinion and act on that opinion.
What is your view on cancel culture these days?
Okay, we've gone overboard. We've gone overboard. And look, it's the same thing. Every movement starts out cool. Me Too starts out with the best of intentions. Black Lives Matter starts out with the best of intentions. And then we're taking everything to the extreme. There's no modulation. So somebody flirting with somebody becomes the same as somebody who rapes somebody. There's no needle. There's no median. And we're going too far. We're attacking people. Look, everybody makes a mistake. Now, like I said, there are mistakes and there are transgressions and then there are crimes. They're not all the same thing.
I agree.
I mean, that's one of the things that get me about social media is that most people are not great with words. They're not. I know this. I taught English in high school. Okay. And just not everybody can get the thoughts in their head out of their mouth as clear as possible. And sometimes people choose a wrong word and then they get a stake driven through their heart. And honestly, we've lost our balance. We've become unkind. We become unkind because we don't allow people to make mistakes. And yet, if we make a mistake, we beg everybody to bear with us and ask for forgiveness. And it's just not fair.
It's so well said. So well said. Okay, so you've had all these incredible roles. You have had not just the roles, but you've also been one of the most respected voices in the roles that you've had. So
well,
people, it's true. People really care about your point of view, your opinion. When you look back on your career, do you have a favorite role or a favorite time?
Gosh, and look, Egg Magazine was an incredible opportunity when Malcolm Forbes came to me and just said, create a magazine for me that's about everything fresh and new. And the fact that I created a wonderful team, all of whom have gone on to wonderful careers, really successful, that we gave Vanessa Williams her first magazine cover, John Cusack, Annette Bening, Liam Neeson. We discovered Terror Chips. To be given that kind of freedom to just allow somebody's journalistic ability to explore the things that make me happy, the things that get me excited about life. I don't understand being bored. I don't think I've ever been bored in my life. If I have, I move on. But I certainly have never said, I'm bored. I don't get it. What is wrong with you if you're bored? There's so much fun to be had. There's so much excitement to be had. There's so much challenge to be had. I think one of the great things I learned from Malcolm, from Mr. Forbes, who is such a brilliant man. And, you know, when you look at his career and how many people he helped and what Forbes magazine was in its time. And he was a man who was so relentlessly curious. He made you realize that the more you know, the more there is to learn. To me, it's like you're always in school. And I don't say that as a negative. Besides Malcolm, I had a mom who was a relentless learner. My mom was wicked smart and just kept on learning. And she didn't understand stopping. I think maybe it's a combination. My mom, Malcolm, being brought up Jewish, just the idea that life is a continuing education course. And so I think Egg was an incredible opportunity. I can't just be one. I think the fact that I walked into the New York Times one day for a meeting and walked out as the men's editor of the New York Times, that was my first job in fashion. I mean,
wait,
I feel a little funny.
Back up for a second. You walked in for what kind of meeting?
I didn't know. I was called into the New York Times to meet the great Carrie Donovan, at that time, and Warren Hoke, who edited the magazine. And I figured they just wanted me to write an article. Egg magazine had folded. I was back to freelancing. I had a great column in The New Yorker called The Edge of Nightlife, where I was able to write about anything that happened after the sun went down, which gives you an incredible opportunity to go from anything from an argument of a couple on a subway platform to an all-night restaurant to a great S&M club.
Those are great guardrails.
It was a marvelous column. Anyway, I walked in having no idea what it was about. I thought they just wanted me to write a piece. And all of a sudden, they asked me what I thought of the menswear at the New York Times. And I said, I don't think about the menswear in the New York Times.
See, this is HAL 101, literally.
Yeah. Why would I pay attention to clothing that you're stuck in two stories? You're stuck in Paul Stewart. You're stuck in Paul Stewart and Orvis.
These
clothes don't apply. Clothes don't apply to anybody's life, I know. I said, you have no fun here. There's no sex appeal here. You're missing everything that designers are doing. And 15 minutes into the conversation, Carrie got up and said, oh, give him the job already, and walked out. And I said, what job? What kind of job are we talking about? And they said, would you like to be men's style editor of the New York Times? And I said, well, I guess so. Why not? I mean, I liked fashion, but I didn't go to FIT. I didn't go to Parsons. Yes, my grandmother was a seamstress, and I learned how to sew because we didn't have a lot of money. You know, and I love clothes. My parents were always nicely dressed, but I didn't have that fashion education that a lot of my contemporaries did. But suddenly that was my job. And sometimes I always feel funny when I talk to young students and, you know, people go in as interns and I said, you have to do the work. You have to go bag the clothes and drag them around and do the errands and get the coffee, because I never did any of that.
And actually, that's probably a good thing. But Hal, if someone would go on an interview today with someone at the level of a Carrie Donovan and basically just trash the editorial in the magazine, do you think they would get the job today?
It depends on the openness and the intelligence of the person you're talking to.
That's true.
The fact is, when you look at, you know, it was quite obvious or evident to me, they called me in obviously because they knew there was something wrong.
Right.
But the fact is, if I'm walking into the meeting and either a Xenia suit or a Calvin suit, whatever it is, and you're all standing there and, you know, some Brooks Brothers stuff. So I had an incredible antipathy towards those type of clothes, because they were men's clothing is uniform. It had nothing to do with style. It had nothing to do with showing a personality. Clothes are there to reveal who you are. Clothes are your calling card. Clothes are your signpost. If you come into an interview, the interview starts the moment I see what you're wearing.
Is that only in fashion, or do you think that's
anything? That is everywhere. If you think people are not clocking what you have on, you're nuts. If you think a person's not looking at the fact that your shoes aren't shined, or that your pants haven't been creased properly, or that the dress you're wearing is two sizes too big, everybody sees everything. They look at your haircut. They look at your makeup. They look at your belt buckle. They look at the bag you carry. Everybody does this. And yes, social media has made this more acute than ever. And so this goes for I don't care if you're going for a job at Walmart. Everybody looks at what you have on. Your clothes. Look, in this day and age, we judge books by their cover, because we don't have time to talk to people because we make judgments. So it's your job to dress like a bestseller. Okay, because everybody's looking at your book jacket, and your book jacket is literally your jacket. So the choices you make, and that's, again, it's not about spending $7,000 to go to Dunhill and get a suit, or $15,000 to go to Dior to buy a dress. You can look amazing going to Zara. You can go look amazing, but it's knowing how to choose what's right for you. And honestly, it's nothing more than looking in a mirror and smiling and going, I look cool.
Okay, that line about dressing like a bestseller is the best line I've ever heard. Love it. Okay, so if you think back, what would you say was your most challenging role? The hardest role, the most stressful role, the one that you constantly had to be on your toes, if there was one?
Like, I think InStyle, easily. Now, I started writing for InStyle while I was still at the New York Times. Martha called me. She was a fan of Egg magazine, and she'd seen my work at the New York Times and the special things we had done at Egg, like, you know, the $100 shopping spree where I would give Jeffrey Bean $100 or Carolina Herrera and take them to an Army Navy store at 14th Street and said, you have $100 to put together an outfit that looks like something you might design. And it became an exercise in style.
That's awesome.
And became an incredibly popular column and totally ripped off by so many people. But when I first left the New York Times to go to InStyle, you cannot believe how many people in the industry felt sorry for me.
Wow. It was like,
there was pity on their faces. And so pitiful to the point where when I was at InStyle and I would go to the fashion shows by myself initially, I was invited to everybody's party. Vogue invited me, Glamour invited me, Harper's Bazaar, everybody, because they felt so bad for me that I'd made this stupid choice in my life.
Why was it stupid?
Because I was going to this magazine that, unlike the other magazines, didn't think fashion uber alles, that fashion was more important than anything else in the world. And here was this magazine that was going to be pragmatically about how to fit fashion into your life, that very important, how to dress high, low. We were the first magazine to do that, to say that you can wear something high end with a t-shirt from the Gap. And this idea that how do you pragmatically work fashion into your life while you have other things that are more important, like your job, your family, your children. Okay. Fashion's not the most important thing in the world, though it matters a lot. But what matters more is your happiness and the people around you, your health. And people were like, huh? I'm like, what did you do? And what did you do? And those first 2 years at InStyle, we worked so hard to prove our point. We worked so hard with incredible information, with incredibly strong opinions, but with a sense of humor, with going back to that attitude of, come here, I have something to tell you. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, with the idea you can do this, that fashion was an option for everyone, not for somebody who could only afford a Chanel jacket. And most, I mean, now it seems so common, but back then it was not. I remember being at an ad meeting with a woman from Louis Vuitton who was just had such an attitude towards the magazine. There was no way she was coming in. And as she was talking to me, she leaned forward to give me an espresso. And she was wearing this sort of beautiful rust-colored Vuitton suit, market designed, I guess. And as she leaned forward, I noticed there was like a pocket square on her t-shirt that was underneath it. And I said, you keep snapping at me. I said, I got to ask you a question. Are you wearing a Gap t-shirt? And of course she was.
Oh my God.
And I said, you're exhibit A of everything I'm talking about.
Oh my God. She must have died.
Yeah. And then she took an ad, you know.
But how, why was this challenging for you?
It was challenging because it was an uphill battle.
It was
an uphill battle convincing fashion houses, especially European fashion houses, that it was not necessarily about having Patrick DeMarchelier shoot you running in some field chasing thoroughbred horses, that wasn't what fashion was about. Fashion was, what do I wear to go to work? Fashion was, what kind of shoes do I wear when I have to walk on a city street? Fashion was, how do I get the right dress for a wedding when you realize that a wedding lasts 5.5 hours? So it's not just a pretty dress. What kind of dress do I want to be in for 5.5 hours? So it was taking fashion off a runway and putting fashion in real life.
Yeah.
In real life, saying, what kind of dress can I wear to work? And then afterward, go meet my husband for dinner. So it's a dress that has to last 12 hours on you. Fashion makes no sense if it's just of the moment. Yes, if you're just taking a snapshot, hooray. But fashion has to work. Fashion has to work the way food has to work, the way you have to work. It has to be over a period of time in real life. And so how do you put clothes in real life? And it sounds odd to say it now. Nobody else was doing it at the time. As pragmatic and as logical as it sounds now, it took an astounding amount of convincing for a lot of people.
Yeah. You know what? Thinking back on it, I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay. Let's shift gears because I think fashion is one of the industries, actually, it's probably maybe one of the only industries where someone tells you to do something and you're literally like, how the fuck am I going to ever get this done? It's like the most insane challenge. It's almost like you're on a competition show all the time. What would you say is the craziest thing you've ever had to get done in your career? And how did you do it?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. Actually, it wasn't fashion. It was catering.
Okay, tell us.
It was catering. I had a catering business and I got hired by Doyle Dane Birnbach to do their 35th anniversary party, which was 850 people on a Circle Line boat. and they wanted a barbecue. And there are certain rules about boats and fire. That's number one. Number two, it gets better. The crews and the boats at that time were operated by, let's just call them the Teamsters, but it was really somebody else. It was another kind of family. and I wasn't willing to pay them off.
Oh, God.
And because I wasn't willing to pay them off, they locked the kitchen. So I wasn't allowed to use it. So we had to pull off a barbecue for 850 people without a kitchen.
How'd you do that?
We brought in proofing ovens. We brought in portable sinks and plumbing systems. We literally built a kitchen on the deck of the boat outside the kitchen.
Served
850 people, about 450 pounds of ribs, about 350 pounds of barbecue chicken, about 17 cheesecakes that I cooked in proofing ovens with a blowtorch. And so, yeah, that may be the most challenging thing.
The only regret is that you were not on some reality TV show where this could have been
right, documented. Exactly. The other challenging things, it was very funny working the details because Details was always on a budget. And the way we made our money was a lot of times was our role at Details was we had to go out at night, always. Oh, because about nightlife. And most of the staff was a lot younger than I was by that point. I was in my mid to late 30s. I'd already done my nightlife. I was over it. But in order to be part of it, you had to go out. We would go out to area. We go that. We'd Jägermeister, which is one of the most disgusting things in the world to drink, was a big sponsor of Details magazine. So I would have to go out basically at night and stay out until 4 o'clock in the morning and then get up in the morning and go working at the publishing house that I was working at and then leave there and then go work at Details.
Wow.
So it was just a hell of a time. But it's amazing how much energy you have when you do things that you love. You're excited about what you're doing.
So that's a perfect segue because legitimately my next question is, and I feel this way about you all the time, and I know you're never bored, so I get that, but your energy is never ending. I mean, you were like this all day long, every day. I know this.
Yes.
How? What is your secret? And you're a Gemini, aren't you?
Yeah. My birthday is on Monday.
Happy almost birthday. I'm a Gemini also.
I guess I've just always been curious. Really, I'm just curious. I'm just fascinated about things I don't know. I'm fascinated watching somebody put together an Adirondack chair and want to know how. I just think, I know this sounds so corny, but there's so much about life that you know shit about. And it's amazing when you discover it. It's like, let's say you travel to Tahiti. Okay, I've hated tattoos my whole life. I have no interest in having one. I've never wanted one. Nothing. Okay. And then you go to Tahiti or Samoa and these guys have these amazing block tattoos. I would get one in a minute. They were astounding. And I want to know how they're done. I had to meet the tattoo artist and how it's done and how they get that ink and how much time you have to sit there in order to create that. We went to Fiji and stayed at this resort that, the Wakaya Club that only has like room for 12 or 18 people. I spent half my trip there in the kitchen learning how to cook the things that these people cook because the food was so amazing. I walked in, I said, you have to teach me. You must teach me how to do this.
This is the journalist in you, ask me every question.
It's almost the reverse. And because I asked those questions, I realized I might as well make money as a journalist. My mom was a really curious person, but I honestly don't know exactly where it comes from, but I'm just, most people are intimidated by what they don't know. And it's a shame. People fear the things that they don't understand. And that limits your life. When you get frightened and you walk away, instead of taking your fear, grabbing yourself by the scruff of your neck and saying, walk in for God's sake and ask a goddamn question. And that's me. It's just, I want to know. I'm fascinated by what other people are excited about. I'm fascinated by things I don't understand, whether it's the way you put a Broadway show together or the way you learn how to drive a race car or how to put together a couture dress. To watch other people's skill, to watch other people's passion is just, it's illuminating. It's life affirming. It's energy acquiring. To, let's say, go to fashion and to go into one of the ateliers, the couture houses, and to watch the women they call the petit mains, the little hands, and you watch them put together a couture dress, and you realize the painstaking dedication it takes to make this extraordinary piece of clothing. And it's not about, you know, oh, that dress, you know, that dress is $500,000, whatever it costs. Like, what justifies it? What justifies it is the fact that somebody created something astounding. What justified it is the fact that somebody did something that nobody else could. And you pay for exclusivity. And I think it's also what justifies it is the joy that it brings the person who creates it. I remember once I asked Versace, like, I understood spending $50,000 on a sculpture. I understood, you know, him spending $50,000 on a painting. How do you justify spending $50,000 on a dress? And I'm not advocating everybody does this, but I was curious to know, in this part of the world, how do you justify this couture? And he said, because of the pleasure it will give you, that he said, look at it. He said, nobody else can do this. I said, yes, but when you die, I said, those paintings you bought will live on. The sculpture will live on. He said, but what about the dress? He said, do you think I give a shit what happens to any of my paintings and my sculpture when I die? He said, I bought them because they make me happy now.
Mm.
And I think I think that's the thing with clothing. But what I look for is discovery. I want to learn, again, I know it sounds corny, I want to learn one thing new every day.
Hal, you know this is a TV show, right?
Yeah.
Because it just sounds like your next TV show of just discovering.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. But it's just, you know, the old Auntie Mame line, life is a banquet and most poor suckers are starving to death. There's incredible validity in that. There's so much. Yes, I know we're really in a very unhappy world. We're living in a world that basically is almost exclusively focused on the negative. And I don't know if we're going to come out of this. We're in a bad place, especially in the United States. We're in a terrible place right now. That said, I can only do so much to change that. And that changes my vote. That changes my vote. You can talk and you can watch MSNBC until your face falls off. That's going to change nothing. Your vote will change everything. But that said, on a daily basis, that's still not my world. On a daily basis, there's still so much possibility for joy and happiness and comfort in front of you. It's so important as somebody, look, I am not a child. I am getting up there. And I always thought that when you get older, the way we were taught is that as you get older, you slow down. Well, that's bullshit. I mean, that's absolute nonsense. Why are you slowing down? Why are you stopping the things you love to do, the things you love to do less? I just get more fascinated by life. But I think one of the things you have to learn more about is your health and self-care.
What is the happy grown-up?
The happy grown-up is a celebration of life after 50. The fact that there are over 100 million Americans over the age of 50, that we control about 73% of the disposable income in this country. We control over 80% of the household income in this country. And we're not aging the way, not just our parents did, we're not aging the way we did 10 years ago. Our desire for opportunity, our desire for new acts, our desire to stay healthy, to be fresh, to find new opportunities, to enjoy the rest of our lives, to enjoy each other. And yet, less than 15% of advertising in America is aimed at anyone over the age of 35. And what I want to do is I want to focus on people doing wonderful things with their lives after 50. Number one, to teach people, yes, how do we age? Not gracefully. That's so wussy. No, how to age with excitement, how to age with energy, how to age with joy, and therefore to bring people in and talk to them like Damon John, like Norma Kamali, like Beth Ann Hardison, like Mindy Grossman, Tim Gunn, all these people who, when you think about these people, are Beth Ann's 78 years old.
You would never even know.
Mindy's in her mid 60s and running her fourth company. Tim Gunn didn't be known to anybody till he was 55 years old. And these people are just, they're such incredible exhibits A through F of the possibility of how to keep getting, I call it new aging.
I love it.
How to new age with energy, excitement, and happiness. There's no reason. The one thing, I have an almost photographic memory of my past and my history. And yes, I should probably write a book about that stuff. And my husband will not stop, you know, until I do. Yes, I know everything I ever did in the 70s. And most people can't remember, but I do. But I am the least nostalgic person you will ever meet. Because although I could tell you stories of exploits and jobs and people I met, I don't long for it. I don't want it to come back. I think it's really weird that all this conversation after the pandemic, you know, we're almost back to normal. No, first of all, we're not back to normal. And number two, I don't want to go back to, if you think about it, where we were before the pandemic was not so great. It wasn't that wonderful. Okay. So let's create new. Let's create new systems. Let's create new schemes. Let's create new patterns to live. I think one of the things we learned over the pandemic is we came to a lot more concerned, one, with our home, two, with our family, and three, with our health. And I think these are things we should not drop to, quote, go back to normal. No, these things should be integrated into our world and into our lives. And especially one of the things we also learned was how precious our time is, how precious it is to have conversations with different generations. Beth Ann says, has a great thing when she talks about, and those of you who don't know who Beth Ann Hardison is, you really should. She was one of the first Black models. She basically helped create diversity in the industry. She is now a Gucci ambassador. She works for advocacy and diversity in the fashion industry. She's 78, is the most independent person I've ever met in my entire life. Norma Kamali is 75 and looks like she's 55. Yes. Her business has never been bigger and never been more growing. And these people all talk about the fact that it is so important for people who are older to talk to people who are younger. Whether you understand their outlook on life, nevertheless, you need to learn it. They know things you don't know. But it's equally important for people who are younger to speak to people who are older, because we've been places you haven't, because we're better storytellers than you are. We can help you avoid stepping in the mud puddles if you're willing to listen. But I think it's such an exciting time to get older, right? I don't think it's never been a more vibrant time to age in this country than right now. And I'm excited about it. And I want other people to be excited. I don't want them to bemoan the fact that they're getting older, that they're turning 60, they're turning 70. Hey, the alternative really sucks. You got up. My husband, God bless him, my husband's a civil engineer, doesn't seem to be the most emotional person in the world. And yet he gets up every morning and I'm not kidding you, he does this. He gets up in the morning and goes, I got up. He looks at the dog. The dog is breathing. He looks at Hal. Hal's still breathing. Okay. He walks into the bathroom. He says, I got here. He looks in the mirror, realizes he can still see, and goes into the mirror and actually says, it's not going to be such a bad day.
Oh, I love it.
Well, I love him. I want people back to a place where acquiring joy, regardless of your age, regardless of your place, becomes a key factor of your day.
I love it. That's so well said. So Happy Grown Up. I mean, yeah. I can already see the joy that it's going to bring. Is it a website? Is it a podcast?
It's both a website and it will be a podcast. Amazing. And then hopefully we're having talks now with different people. We'll do in-person forums and discussion groups. I would like to start a dialogue between the people who subscribe and come in. We want to launch the beginning of September, I hope. I want people to come here as a source of conversation, not to bitch and gripe, because I'll turn you right off, but to share your discoveries or to ask questions. Lily Tomlin, Jane Wagner, who writes for Lily, Jane's wife, she once said, how come nobody thinks of trying softer? And it's a brilliant statement. And I think that's it. I think we come at life sometimes too hard, and just taking a little bit of a step back, but to focus on what you can accomplish today, one day at a time. One day at a time, to just slow it down. Our world is too much with its foot on the gas. Just think about the tagline of a certain food product. You're going to love it in an instant. No, I'm not. I'm going to love very few things in an instant. But to love something is a process of discovery. And I want to give people the tools to be able to discover those things, to find those things that make them really happy and to embrace them. It's just, God, it's so easy to be negative in this world. It really is. And yet our time is so short. And I think that's one of the graces I think you get about when you get older. You're so much more aware that you're not invincible and that your time is short. So why are you wasting time? So you do have the advantage of saying, you know what? This isn't working for me. Cut it. I'm gone. I'm mm-hmm. out of here. Also, as you get older, one of the things you realize is you truly don't give a shit what other people think.
Oh my God.
No, you don't.
I know you don't. So, I mean, no, I totally agree. It's the zero fucks given. It's like, at this point, who cares? If you're going to do what makes you happy. You're going to surround yourself with
makes people me happy. That
make you happy. Of course.
And what makes the people around me happy. And I think sometimes in our mania, you know, of news gathering and to look at the worldview, and I'm not discounting what's happening in Ukraine. I'm not discounting what's happening in this country right now, which is not a good thing. I'm not discounting poverty throughout the world, but there's that world, and then there's your immediate world. There's that world of your family. Their safety, their happiness, their joy, that's really more than anything else what's key to the balance in your life. And yeah, these people are precious. These people are precious, and they need to know that they're precious. They need to be held close. They need to be nurtured. They need to be excited. And that's your job. That's your responsibility. And I think that to me in some ways is the essence of happy grown up, is the fact that if your world, if your immediate world is happy, if you can go through that world happy, you will make the rest of the world a happier place.
So last question, which is always, how do you want to leave your mark? In one sentence, what do you want to be remembered for in this world?
Whenever I was with Hal, I always had a good time.
Okay. And that is definitely true for everyone who's ever been around you.
Yeah, he always made me smile.
Oh, I love it. How? So great. I'm so excited to see when it comes out. You've just been such a force your entire career. I'm so honored to have worked with you. And thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, hey, it was a joy to be here.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.